This is the Taxpayers Federation podcast, where we are fighting for lower taxes, less waste, and more accountable government. I'm Chris Sims. I'm the Alberta director for the CTF. I'm joined by two of my friends, Franco Terrazano. He's our federal director. We just sent him home to Mordor. He was here for Christmas around the corner in Lethbridge, God's country, but we just sent him back to Ottawa. And special guest, we don't usually have this chance. We're chatting with our boss, the CEO and president of the Taxpayers Federation, Scott Hennig. Scott is stationed just outside of Alberta's capital near Edmonton. Gentlemen, I wanted to kind of do a little bit of a year in review, but not so much. More of a signals check of where are we right now in the fight for things like lower taxes, less waste, more accountable government, and where are we going? So that is why it was Franco's great idea to talk to Scott, because Scott's been in this game for an awful long time. Where are we right now?
Make me feel old, Chris.
I'm older than you, just for the record. I remember when Reagan won the first time. So where are we right now, Scott, in the fight for lower taxes? I got to say, we're fresh off of the interview with Dr. Jordan Peterson and Pierre Poilievre. It's got millions of views, and they're talking about stuff like low taxes and smaller government. It's amazing. Where are we?
Yeah, I hate using sports analogies because not everyone watches sports, but it's kind of one of those things where your team has been losing, and then, you know, you've got this, like, you know, star quarterback who's throwing passes and you're really excited and they're marching down the field and you're like, we've already won this one. It's already done. Like, we've got this one. And then you're like, whoa, hang on a minute. Like, there's still so much to go. Like, I mean, it's easy to get excited about the trajectory of where we're going. Like, I just to carbon taxes. I mean, obviously, I got my carbon tax sweatshirt on right now, but like, the carbon tax has been so beaten up, and like a lot of people are like, oh, it's already gone. It's not gone. We're still paying it. It's going to go up on April 1st. Like, there's so much more work to happen between now and whenever an election might be. And we'll talk about that later. But like, there's so much work to do. There's so much work to do to get this thing over the finish line. And a lot of people are just wanting to move away from it, be like, okay, what's the next fight? And I agree that we need to think about what the next fights are. That's, you know, what I think about all the time is what's the next fight. But there's so, you know, this is what happens when, you know, you're on the 2-yard line and you go to throw the football in and someone picks it off and runs it the other way. Like, we don't know. Obviously, everything in Ottawa right now is like a tinderbox ready to explode if it already hasn't. And that can mean all kinds of crazy things. Like, crazy things happen. And we don't know what the next 8 months are going to look like, but it could be wild. It could be wild. We could have changes in leaders and prime ministers, and all kinds of crazy things could happen that will change the game. And just because we're marching down the field doesn't mean anything's over. Like, you cannot stop pushing for these sorts of things or you're going to lose.
Do you think that the popularity of Pierre Poilievre's leadership is largely due to things like him saying he wants to axe the tax? Is it because of those meat and potatoes things?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite quote from any politician of all time is Ralph Klein, former Alberta premier, my province. He said, my job is to figure out where the parade is going so I can run to the front of it. And I think that is like the most honest, like unfiltered comment from a politician, because they all do that. They all do that. They, at least the good ones do. Even the ones who aren't populists still want to be popular. Like, it's the name of the game. And figuring out where the parade is going and running to the front of it is what politicians do. So, you know, I will give certainly I'll give Mr. Poilievre a ton of credit when it comes to things like inflation. During the pandemic, when he started talking about the government money printing and the inflation, I honestly was like, ooh, like, I remember 2008, 2009, when the Harper government was printing money, and not at the same level, to be fair, not even in the same stratosphere, but they were printing money. And I remember economists and people, you know, even here were saying like, this money printing may lead to inflation, and it never came. We never saw the inflationary impact of that money printing. Now, if that was like a quarter, like maybe a tenth, I'd have to go look at the numbers. Like, it was a fraction of the money printing that went on during the pandemic. And when Poilievre started talking about this is going to lead to inflation, I remember being like, oh, that's a bold prediction, because we were wrong last time. And I guess we were just wrong on scale. That's all it was, is that we just didn't simply print enough money last time for it to really take over the inflation. But this time it did. And so I think that on those sorts of files, I think he's been a leader. I think he's been a leader in terms of the debate around Canada on inflation and money printing, which, like, you know, when Trudeau says he doesn't think about monetary policy, everyone's like, you should have thought about money. But nobody was thinking about monetary policy prior to all this money printing. Now, somebody should have been. Mm-hmm. Somebody should have been thinking about monetary policy. I know Franco was, but
yeah,
somebody should have been thinking about
me. Yeah.
Yeah, someone should have been thinking about monetary policy in that government. Polyev was. He was thinking about monetary policy, and he accurately predicted this inflation. He was right about that. And I think that there he's been a leader. On some of the other files, I think he's been a bit of a follower, and that's fine. And I don't begrudge that, because that's what good politicians are, is they find the parade and they run to the front of it. And I think on the carbon tax, let's not forget, like, he ran for the Conservative Party in 2021 when they ran on a carbon tax. Like, this is not a, like, every, you know, the Conservatives have been against the carbon tax forever. They haven't been. They haven't been. They were silent in 2015 when they didn't have, when they didn't have a leader. They were silent in the House when Trudeau was bringing in the first carbon tax. They were, you know, really at that time in 2015, it was Brad Wall and it was the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. We're the only ones really, like, screaming about the carbon tax back in 2015. I mean, I remember the wild rose in Alberta, even when Notley brought it in. I mean, all the oil company executives standing behind her on stage. Wild Rose was like, we probably don't like the carbon tax and we probably would make it revenue neutral. And I remember Paige McPherson, our Alberta director at the time, having to, like, get out the sticks and beat Brian Jean, the leader of the Wild Rose at the time, to get him back in line, because he kept saying stuff like, well, we'll probably change some things about the carbon tax. No, you need to get rid of the carbon tax. So, like, Brad Wall, great, has been a leader on this file. I don't recall 2015, you know, 2016, Pierre Poilievre being as rabid against the carbon tax as he is today. And that's not to say that he wasn't against it. He just wasn't as vocal about it. And certainly in 2021, when his leader was putting forward a carbon tax, was running to win the election on the idea of having his own carbon tax that you could then get, you know, credits for your green bikes or your e-bikes or whatever kind of
thing. I think it was solar blenders was the term.
So ridiculous. It was legitimately a worse carbon tax than the one we have now. It might have been lower, but at least we get some money back. That one, we were going to get credits to buy green things. Like, it was stunning how stupid of an idea it was. It was stunning how absolutely stupid of an idea they came up with. A worse carbon tax than the one that Justin Trudeau had, and they rightfully lost the election. But I mean, look, I wasn't at the doorsteps with him in 2021 when he was knocking on doors. I don't know what he was saying privately at the time, but there wasn't anyone in that caucus who was actively, openly fighting their leader, Erin O'Toole, on the carbon tax of 2021. So things have changed. Things have certainly changed. And I will give him credit. He has now taken up the mantle. He is leading the parade. He is getting out people to talk about these things. I mean, even during his leadership, he took it on as one of his first issues. So he has rightfully identified that this is an issue that Canadians are livid about. Something we knew since 2015, something we knew since 2008. I mean, we've been on this file for, it seems like, almost two decades, and we've seen the devastating effects of carbon tax. We've seen what kind of damage it does. We know what kind of impact it has on actual real Canadians. And I'm just so thankful that we have at least one party right now talking about the fact that this is devastating for the economy.
I would say, he didn't say so publicly, but when O'Toole came out and broke our promise, because people might remember he signed a pledge, no carbon taxes. That was back when Aaron Woodrick was standing there next to him when he was running for leadership. I would say O'Toole signed his warrant then. The moment he did that, there was a huge push within the caucus. There was a huge division within the caucus of pro and anti-carbon tax. The majority of the MPs were still anti-carbon tax and could not believe what on earth the leadership was doing at the time. So it's really refreshing to see him win such a decisive leadership win within his own party and stick to it. I just listened to Trudeau a couple of days ago sneering at the idea of, things that fit on bumper stickers. Yeah, clarity's good. Clarity's real good. Franco, I know you want to get in here. Where did you want to go with inflation? Like, and to your point, Scott, I remember distinctly when Paulia was bringing this up, because he was on with my former host, Evan Solomon. And Solomon was saying, like, you're nuts for even thinking about inflation. This is not going to happen. Borderline calling him a conspiracy theorist. And Polyev stuck to his guns. In fact, he was actually writing a book at the time that never did get published on the issue of inflation, which is why I found it fascinating that to Peterson the other day, he called it an immoral tax. Franco, you, to your credit too, you were talking about this when they were printing hundreds of billions of dollars out of thin air. What do you think the difference was this time around from when Scott was saying? Is it because we had industry shut down at the same time?
Yeah, well, I mean, the government did create the perfect storm for inflation. So on the one hand, you had the government, the central bank, printing up about $300 billion during the pandemic out of thin air, right? So you had too many dollars chasing too few goods. And obviously the problem and where inflation comes when you have the government financing deficits through the printing press, which is what happened during the pandemic here in Canada, is that they're printing up new dollars out of thin air, but you can't print up new farmland out of thin air. You can't print up new gasoline out of thin air. You can't print up new grocery stores out of thin air. And so while the government was printing all this money, the government across Canada, not just the feds, but municipally, provincially, what have you, had Canadians in perpetual lockdown for what, 2-3 years, right? So not only was the government creating all this new cash out of thin air, the inflation tax, but you also had politicians, you had the lockdowns, you had the different types of regulations that just wasn't allowing our economy to produce the stuff that money buys. That is the perfect storm for inflation. Too many dollars chasing too few goods. Now, how was the central bank printing up all this money? Well, largely by buying government debt. Directly or indirectly, at the very least, financing the massive deficits in Ottawa. That is the inflation tax. Now, I listened to that interview as well. Mr. Polyev was right to call it a very immoral tax. A couple reasons for that is, number one, it's also very regressive, right? So the inflation, like if you're making 300,000, 500,000, $1 million a year, like you notice inflation kind of. But when you're making like $40,000, $50,000, that's who's really getting shafted from inflation, number one. Number two, if you already have assets, well, inflation might make you better off as stock prices go up, as real estate prices go up, as other asset prices go up. But number three, right? Inflation is fundamentally undemocratic. When the government votes on an income tax increase, well, you know who voted on the income tax, right? When the central bank prints a whole bunch of money out of thin air, no politicians are voting on it. It's a fundamentally undemocratic form of taxation. But, you know, let me just go back to where Scott left off with the carbon tax, because let me tell you a funny anecdote. When Scott kicked me out of Alberta and said, hey, pack your bags, you're going to Mordor. Well, I got to Ottawa at like July of 2021. I remember the first dinner I went to, just went out to get some food with a couple buddies. One of the buddies was a conservative insider lobbyist strategist. And you know what he told me? He's like, you know, Franco, we love you guys. We love the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. But can you guys just drop this whole carbon tax bit? Yeah. With his mouth, he said, look, there's no way any government ever will get elected opposing the carbon tax.
Okay.
Well, it's only been a couple years, and now it seems like there's no way anybody ever will get elected running on a carbon tax. And so, look, where are we right now before we look at the year ahead? Honestly, we're in a pretty bad state if you look at the objective facts, right? Taxes just went up again on New Year's Day. Payroll taxes just went up. A carbon tax hike is scheduled for April 1. The government just posted a $62 billion deficit, doubled the debt in less than a decade. So things are really bad objectively, and that's why people are feeling so much pain. But the nice thing, I think, is that the tide is turning. People are understanding that it's the government that is making their lives more expensive through the money printing, the massive deficits, and the tax hikes. So I'm very optimistic, but I think 2025 is going to be a very pivotal year for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, for our supporters, to really change the course of Canada for the better.
to put a point on it with numbers, you mentioned the debt. For our listeners who are regulars, they know this. But if you're new to the show, our national debt is about $1.2 trillion. That's $1,000 billion. If you started counting loonies right now, like Scrooge McDuck, and you started counting them up, it would take you 30,000 years to count to 1 trillion. That's how much debt we're in. The interest we pay on the debt is the equivalent of what we pay in the GST.
Ain't that nice?
Yeah, it's pretty gross. Scott, where do you see our next biggest fight? To your point, we have not finished the game. Okay, to your point, the puck is not in the net. The whistle has not been blown. Scott also does refereeing when he's in hockey, so he likes this part, and he's also an Oilers fan. So we can't celebrate yet, but let's just predict. Let's say that Pierre Poilievre wins. He keeps his promise. He scraps the carbon tax before lunch on his first day. What's our next fight? Where do you see the puck going after this?
Yeah. So, I mean, just on the stay on the tax side for a second. Okay. Capital gains is a big one. That one has been, I know that not everyone pays capital gains taxes, and it's not necessarily one that hits every single person like the carbon tax does. But it has widespread, long tentacles that impact everyone because it hits investment. I mean, we're seeing already people talk about, like I talked to people who are pulling their money out and going to the U.S., I mean, especially now that Trump's been elected and they see big open for business signs happening in the U.S., they're picking up their money and they're moving to the U.S. with it. That's jobs. That's trade. Like that's such it has an impact. You don't see it necessarily every day. But when the jobs start drying up and we start seeing unemployment rates go back up, that's where we're like, where's all the investment? And we have not seen the investment in Canada like we've seen in the U.S. over the past decade. And this capital gains tax hike is going to make it even worse. That's one I actually, you know, where we have not yet heard from Poilievre that he would reverse it. And that's, I think that's going to be a big fight, one that I'd love to see him on the record on. Just again, on the carbon tax issue, the industrial carbon tax. You know, we've talked about the consumer carbon tax. He's been, you know, axed the tax. We've not heard explicitly that Pierre Poilievre wants to get rid of the industrial carbon tax. Again, one that you're not necessarily thinking you're paying directly, but I mean, if you buy any sort of goods, if you're buying fertilizer that is used to grow food in this country, it's a huge industrial carbon tax on it. Oil and gas, huge industrial carbon tax on it. And I know that that's one that has been, you know, has been quiet. So there's a few other tax issues still that need to be figured out with Pierre Poilievre. And after the, you know, certainly after the election, we want to see a move on those things. But I'd love to see commitments before the election, because trying to get a commitment out of a politician after an election, it's much harder, much, much harder than it is right now. Going away from the tax stuff, obviously you touched on the debt. I mean, we've got a big, huge problem. When you know, to your point, when every dollar you pay in GST is going just to pay the interest on the debt, we're in big trouble. We're in big, big trouble. And I know that interest rates are starting to fall again now that inflation is a bit under control. But I mean, we're still paying through the nose on this debt. I mean, it's doubled. You know, maybe our listeners already know the story, but when we relaunched the national debt clock in 2000, and I guess it would have been 2011. So I won't go through the whole history. We only have so much time today, but we dug out the debt clock. We're coming up with the new one. We're getting it fixed up in 2011 in London, Ontario, found a place that fixes these things. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever think we'd have to add a digit. Like, we're like, oh, it's fine. It goes up to $990 billion. And that time, the debt was like 500 and some, and it took us 150 years to get to that point. So we weren't concerned about like, oh, well, we got to add an extra digit. We didn't want that extra digit confusing people. Left that digit off, and here we are. You know, we get to 2021, and all of a sudden we've crossed a trillion, and we had to go buy a new national debt clock. We literally had to go out and build an entire new national debt clock because we didn't have enough digits. Like, if that isn't the saddest commentary, I don't know what is. So, and that has real, like, it's not just some ethereal number in space that, oh, that's someone else's problem. It's our problem, and we have to deal with it. Talk about immoral. Like, you talked about how inflation is an immoral tax. Debt is an immoral tax on future Canadians. They have no vote on this. They have no say on it. It's no different than if you went out and bought a car or the car loan and said, give it to my neighbor. it's my neighbor's job to pay for it, and they had no say. They don't get to drive the car. I mean, this is money that's already been spent on us that we're saying, you guess what, kids, you get to spend, you get to pay your money to pay for the goods that I got to enjoy. It's absolutely immoral. It's absolutely 100% immoral, and we need to address it. And not just address it because it's immoral. We should. That should be enough. But it's eating up so much of our money. So much of our money on interest is going to this that we need to address it. It's one of the biggest line items in the entire government is just spending money on servicing our debt. So we're fortunate it's not the 1980s. We aren't seeing double-digit inflation and interest rates. But it's huge and it's expensive. So that's one. One that I also want to talk about is that no one's really talking about yet. I know that Pierre, I think he hinted at this in his interview with Peterson, which I haven't watched yet, admittedly, is the Senate. The Senate is, I think, if I pull up my crystal ball, the Senate is going to be a huge issue and a huge fight over the next 2 or 3 years. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun because the senators are, you know, these are people who think so very highly of themselves that any suggestion that they're not like the smartest, wisest, greatest people and making nothing but great decisions for Canadians is going to be like, they're going to be aghast at the fact that people are now paying attention, because no one's paid attention to the Senate. Like, let's remember back in like the Harper years, we were talking about the Senate all the time. How do we reform? How do we fix it? Nobody's been talking about the Senate, which, I mean, maybe to Trudeau's credit, he has quieted down the Senate talk, but it's boiling under the surface, and it is going, I predict it's going to explode in 2026, maybe 2027. We'll see. But I think there's a tinder box there ready to explode.
Do you think that's because they're largely a liberal or independent, whatever you want to call them? They're the majority and they're going to be running up against and running interference against a poly of government. Is that why you think it could explode?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, so there's two things. I think when they changed back in the old days, let's go back in the old days. Back in the old days when they appointed like party bagmen, if you went out and raised a bunch of money for the party and you were like a candidate that would run in unwinnable ridings, that was your prize. You got to be a senator. And they put you in there and you knew you didn't have any sort of special qualifications. You were just a party hack who had, you know, carried the ball up the field for them for so many years that like, here's your reward. And they would go there and they would put on their suits and they would bang on the desk and they would vote for whatever the government wanted, whatever the government was. They just wanted to keep their head down and their paychecks coming in. And, you know, that they were arguably, compared to what we have today, that's a superior system. Now, in no world should we ever have unelected people making laws. In an ideal world, we would never have the situation. This came from an elitist view of the world from 150, 60, 70 years ago, when they looked at it and said, yeah, we can't let all of these unwashed masses make all the laws. We've got to have our aristocrats in there keeping an eye on it. So let's make it so that you have to be old. And at that time, 30 was old. You got to be old. You got to be a landowner. So you got to be wealthy. And then we'll put a few of those people in. We'll appoint them. We won't actually make you go through an election process like the unwashed masses. And then they can just keep, they'll be the adults in the room making sure that these people don't make crazy decisions. That is an elitist, ridiculous view we've seen across the world. Governments have gotten rid of senates that are in this situation. And you got the House of Lords still in the UK, and you got the Senate in Canada, and a lot of other countries have done away with it. Like New Zealand got rid of their Senate. You know, there is, or they've gone to an elected one in Australia. I mean, they've changed these things across the world, except for Canada. We still have this ridiculous notion of having these unelected landowners helping make laws. And again, it was fine when they didn't, they kind of kept their head low. They're no longer doing that because Trudeau changed it so that now he's anointing the smartest, best, most enlightened people. They're all independents and they're eminent people who are picked from a committee. You know, you got to make an application. It's such BS. Like, it's the same kind of people. He's still putting in party bagmen and people who have written nice things about his governments and said nice things on the radio about his governments. And now they're putting these people in and they're calling them independent. They're putting them in non-affiliated caucuses, except for the Conservatives. Conservatives still have a caucus, mm-hmm. but they have these other ones in there, like the Progressive Senators Group, the Independent Senators Group. Like, making them all seem like they're all independent. They're not. Let's just by the numbers. Trudeau has appointed 90 senators. He's currently number three in the history of the country. William Lyon Mackenzie King is number one. He appointed 103 senators. He was the prime minister for 21 and a half years.
I was going to say, yeah.
John A. Macdonald appointed 92. He had to appoint everyone, though. Yeah, there was no Senate. He had no choice. He had to appoint every single senator. There were zero senators at the time.
Yeah. Adam Justin naming Trudeau. The animals. Yes, he had. Yeah,
Justin Trudeau is two behind him. He is two behind him. There are eight vacant seats right now. And between now and October, there's another two come vacant in February, another one in May, another one in June, and another two in September, one in October. Like, there's Justin Trudeau can get close. I don't actually think he can surpass King. I think he can get to 102, though. But that's crazy. Justin Trudeau has been prime minister for 9 years, and he will have potentially appointed 100 senators. 100 senators. There's only 105. So what that's going to leave us with, if Pierre Poilievre is elected as prime minister in let's say October of 2025, let's just say for the sake of argument, he will be left with 10 conservative senators. That's it.
Whoa.
That's it. 10 conservative senators out of 105. So how are they going to get legislation through that the rest of these eminent people appointed by Justin Trudeau, although there is still three appointed by Chrétien that are still there, but the rest have been appointed by Justin Trudeau. I think right now there's 15 Harper senators left. 12 of them are sitting in the Conservative caucus, but two will be coming out. And not all of them are even, not all the conservatives that were appointed by Harper are sitting with the Conservative caucus. So I have very little faith that we're going to get a Senate that wants to play ball with a conservative government. I have very little faith. And if these unelected senators start going out and voting down or delaying bills, which we're seeing already, I mean, we already saw that with, what was the bill, Franco, the farm bill?
So, yeah, I was just going to jump in. Like, we've already got a little taste of it, right? And Trudeau's not even done with his appointments just yet. I mean, you already had, Bill C-234, which was the bill that would take the carbon tax off the natural gas and propane that Canadian farmers use, right? Well, what happened? It was passed by our elected representatives in the House of Commons. It went to the Senate, and then the Senate delayed the bill, gutted the bill, and now that carbon tax relief for farmers and all Canadians is essentially in limbo. Right. It's essentially in limbo. So we just saw that. So, Scott, I'm glad you brought up the Senate fight, because think of Bill C-234 and the fight that we had with the unelected senators, and now add some steroids to that. And that's kind of the fight that we might have in the future if there is a Poilievre conservative government.
That is astonishing. So for people who are, we always get new listeners who are new to the political game. So just to backtrack a little bit. The Senate is, as Scott pointed out, descended from the British parliamentary system called the House of Lords. They were literally those fancy people that you saw in the Jane Austen movies who are landowners. Okay, that is why their chamber is red. It's the royal chamber. And when Scott was talking about, you know, the great unwashed masses over there, he means down the hall in the House of Commons. That's why it's called the Commons, because it was the commoners. Okay. That's actually why the carpet's green, is because it's meant to represent folks meeting in the field and in the hills, as opposed to in court with a king or queen with literally a red carpet. Coming back up to the present day, you just shocked me there, Scott, because I kind of keep an ear on the Senate, but I've been paying attention mostly to the House of Commons. I did not realize that Trudeau has appointed 90? Like, done? They're in?
Yeah, 90. Oh, 90 are already appointed. He's going to get to 100.
Astonishing number.
He's going to get to 100.
So to that point, Franco, has this been... I'm getting the sense this hasn't been making a lot of news and bubbling around in the press gallery a lot in Ottawa about the astonishing number of senators that Trudeau has been naming. Is it talked about at the bars there in Ottawa?
Well, no, I mean, right now, all focus is on the shenanigans in the House of Commons. And that's really where the focus has been for the last year, maybe year and a half. Like, you'll get some of the columnists, right, as some of the major newspaper, some of the more wonky independent online websites. You'll have some columns talking about the problem that a conservative government is going to have because of Trudeau's appointment and because of these senators. But no, it's not facing as much scrutiny as I think Scott rightly points out that it deserves. Now, let me kind of circle back and add my thoughts on where the biggest fights are to come. I'm glad Scott touched on the carbon tax, but I have to reiterate it, right? In Canada, you have at least three different types of carbon taxes. Okay, we have the carbon tax, which everyone thinks about, the consumer carbon tax that directly makes it more expensive for you to fuel up your sedan with gas or to fuel up your Ram with diesel, or makes it more expensive for you to pay your natural gas bill during the winter. That's the consumer carbon tax. Now, married with that is an industrial carbon tax. It works very similar to the consumer carbon tax, where the federal government imposes a mandatory minimum, where provinces either have to impose their own type of carbon tax, both consumer and industrial, or the feds jam their carbon tax down on the citizens of that province. Now, the industrial carbon tax, as Scott has pointed out, is a carbon tax. A carbon tax is a carbon tax is a carbon tax, right? So those costs flow down through the economy to the consumer, making life more expensive. Now, the added issue with this industrial carbon tax is that it also impacts our job prospects. Think about this, right? Think about that fertilizer plant that Scott was talking about. Well, does a fertilizer plant increase production in Canada, or hop across the border and increase production in the United States where there is no carbon tax, right? There is no carbon tax. The Biden administration didn't impose a carbon tax. The Obama administration didn't impose a carbon tax. Good luck on convincing President-elect Donald Trump to impose one. So the industrial carbon tax also needs some looking at. Now, the third carbon tax to talk about, which we've actually coined the second carbon tax, is a sneaky fuel regulation that Trudeau imposed back on Canada Day 2023. Happy Canada Day, right? And that's this carbon tax within fuel regulations that increases the cost over time. So Poilievre has been clear that he will scrap the consumer carbon tax. He's been clear that he'll scrap this fuel regulation carbon tax. What isn't as clear is what is he going to do with the industrial carbon tax? Now, already you've had pressure from these very, very, very smart people in the media, these very, very, very smart academics, these very, very, very smart green activists who have been pushing that carbon tax movement to redouble efforts on the industrial carbon tax. So this is going to be a very hard fight from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, making it public that their one is an industrial carbon tax, two, that it does make life more expensive, that it does make Canada less competitive, and three, to push Poilievre to go fight these big, powerful interests and to scrap every single carbon tax. Okay, so the carbon tax fight, it's not over. There's a lot more work to do, especially with these more hidden types of carbon taxes. What else we're going to see is we're going to start to see academics and other activist groups start to push for different forms of carbon taxes, right? They'll say, okay, scrap a consumer carbon tax, but go do cap and trade. Well, folks, like I said before, a carbon tax is a carbon tax is a carbon tax, and cap and trade is a carbon tax. But also, what you're going to start to see is pressure from international organizations pushing for carbon taxes.
Bingo.
So, we've already seen the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, they're pushing for forms of global carbon taxes. Now, fortunately, the vast majority of countries, about 70%, don't have carbon taxes, right? Including the United States. But that's one other thing to keep an eye on. Chris, I know I've been rambling for a bit, so I'll pass the floor on to you, but I just want to tease this, that I think the next real big fight is going to be with the union bosses here in Ottawa.
Yes, it very well could be. And getting back to your carbon tax and a carbon tax by another name, we have to be really focused on this. So say Pierre Poilievre wins and he's prime minister and he scraps the carbon tax, the consumer carbon tax that you just described. He's also on record repeatedly, and I know he really was not a fan of the second carbon tax, and it's a really hidden thing. So for folks who are listening from British Columbia, you guys have had a second carbon tax there for longer than any other part of Canada, and it's typically why the price at the pump for you is roughly 18 cents a liter extra. Because of that second carbon tax. Now it goes up and down because it's based on an international credit system that they all bid on. It's super complicated. But generally speaking, that is why it's more expensive, even outside of the GVRD, Metro Vancouver, for you to fuel up your cars and trucks. As of right now, it does not apply to home heating fuel, but let's not give them ideas. To your point on Poilievre saying that he, needs to deal with this. He said so during the Peterson interview. And I wanted to actually play a clip from that here because it's something we've all been talking about of, okay, let's say he wins. Let's say he scraps it. What then? What's the next fight? And Peterson asked him a very similar question here. And Poilievre answers, basically, I can't do this by myself. You have to suit up, get in the arena. Politics is not a spectator sport. Listen to this.
But it's going to be a big fight with all of these things because there are so many vested interests that will be trying to hold us back. So many small economic groups that have profited off the status quo, they will be fighting against me. And I'm going to have to put out a call to Canadians that they have to stay politically active. They can't assume that simply by changing by voting in an election, that everything is going to, reverse. All the problems are going to reverse instantaneously. Like, I will need people to put pressure on the Senate to adopt my economic reforms. I will need people to put pressure on their mayors and local councillors to get out of the way and let us build homes. I will need businesses to actually do their part. I mean, our corporate Canada is so completely incompetent when it comes to politics. They're going to have to start to fight for the policies that are good for their workers more aggressively. And I've said that to them. They need to fire their incompetent lobbyists and actually go to the people and make the arguments for the reforms that I'm talking about.
And are the businesses that you're talking to, these are larger businesses, I presume, do they understand your concerns? Are they on board with your
suggestions? They're starting to understand because they know that what they have been doing hasn't worked.
Well, the energy companies have been towing the green line, which seems to me to be a very bad strategy.
They're idiots. They're complete idiots. The big five oil and companies in Canada have idiot lobbyists. They have brilliant workers, incredible workers, but idiot lobbyists. And they've been trying to suck up for the last 10 years and did nothing to support the right policies in the prior years. So that's going to have to change. The developers are going to have to inform people in the cities why housing costs so much. You know, how is it possible that Olivia Chow can raise development charges by 30% and nobody in Toronto knows about it? Well, it's because the builders have not made it known. And so the builders take the blame when the housing costs go up. Mm-hmm. I mean, sorry, you have to actually, politics is a participation sport, not a spectator sport. So our business community is going to have to step up and make the argument for these changes or I will come up against a lot of political barriers. My message to everyone is, God willing, I will triumph in the election, but the people who want the changes that I'm talking about are going to have to stay politically active to push them through and over the finish line.
Okay, so that's where I would argue advocacy groups like the Taxpayers Federation come in, because our tax fighters are really good at zeroing in on politicians. And what he's saying there is, people also need to speak up and push back against what you just said, Franco, unions. And he actually mentioned corporations. Yeah. I find it fascinating that he took on lobbyists and said, quote, they're idiots when it comes to things like carbon taxes, when it comes to things like global carbon taxes coming from outside sources, outside of Canada, pressuring government to do dumb things. So I took a lot of heart from that, of him saying, you know what, I can't do this by myself. I'm going to need people door knocking and suiting up and pressuring these other groups and pushing back on them. Franco, what was your take from that part?
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't agree more, because, like, look, within those cushy office chairs of Parliament Hill and all the office furniture there, I mean, look, a lot of people are going to be talking to the next prime minister and saying, oh, well, you know, it sounds, you know, the people, the rubes, the whatever, the masses are beautiful people. You know, they think one thing is good, but, you know, between us, we have to actually be the adults in the room. We have to have corporate welfare. We have to have these certain type of regulations that strangle economic growth, i.e. really benefit one business and deter all the other small businesses from joining in on the competition. So you're going to have these lobbyists, these big multinational corporations calling for corporate welfare, calling for these niche regulations for their own benefit. But then you're also going to have these academic pressure groups, right? Whether it's the taxpayer-funded academics who are telling the government, oh, you know, you need this regulation. Oh, you know, you need this, these extra tax dollars from Canadians. But then you're also going to have two other groups that we have to worry about, right? You're going to have the union bosses. Mm-hmm. We already saw the PSAC union bosses light their hair on fire. What was it? A couple years ago now, pushing for up to a 47% compensation increase the last time they went on strike. Well, guess what? Even if Poilievre doesn't cut spending, let's say he just increases spending by 2%, which would be awful, they will still light their hair on fire, right? They will still threaten strikes. They will still threaten the sky is going to fall down. So what Mr. Poilievre needs, what his caucus would need if they form government, is a whole bunch of regular Canadians saying, no, 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 I don't care that these greedy union boss bureaucrats want more of our money. Enough is enough. And Mr. Poilievre, you promised to fix the budget and cut taxes. And we expect you to live up to that promise. And we're going to be here fighting with you, right? The third group of people that we're also going to have to push back on is going to be the activist class, especially the green activist class. Mm-hmm. They're going to continue to push for carbon taxes. They're going to continue to push for carbon taxes by other names via regulations. So this is where it's so important to have the taxpayer army ready to fight. And one other thing we're also going to have to do, folks, if there is a Poilievre government, well, we're going to have to hold that government to accountable with the same type of ferocity that we do with the Trudeau government, right? If the next government hikes taxes, if the next government increases spending out of control, then we need the taxpayer army to push that government back into the right direction.
I will also point out that it isn't just the green activists that you would expect at pipeline protests. Really fancy green activists in suits wiggle their way into the boardrooms of energy companies. I'm not kidding. So that is why Poilievre was saying sometimes you run into idiots who are pushing for things like this. And what he meant there was carbon taxes, because I could swing a cat and hit three people who call themselves small government economists, you name it, that call carbon taxes cute things like levies or fees or cap and trade. In fact, when the former leader of the Conservative Party broke his promise and said, actually, I'm going to create some green blender fee, that team phoned us and tried convincing the Taxpayers Federation that their carbon tax wasn't really a carbon tax because we're calling it something different. Newsflash, the Trudeau government doesn't call it a carbon tax either. In fact, there was a Trudeau member of parliament recently at a committee that we were involved with, that we were giving testimony, who played dumb and said, I'm not aware of any carbon taxes in Canada. What are you talking about? So, folks, we need to call folks out on this stuff. Scott, the way that Franco described it there, it reminded me of back when I was first starting with the Taxpayers Federation and I was going to give testimony at a BC finance committee leading up to a budget. And you described it something like this. You're going to have a parade of groups coming through that door saying, we want more money, more, spend. You're going to be the only one in the room saying, stop. That's kind of how I see the next few years, if there's a Poilievre government, that it's our job to be the sober one in the room and telling these folks to stop.
Yeah, no, you're dead right. I mean, Jordan Bateman, who was our former BC director before you, he wrote a book, co-authored a book called Everyone But the People. And it was about the fight in BC over a sales tax increase. And the people on the yes side of the sales tax increase were all the academics, all of the mayors, all the politicians, all the business groups. On the other side was like the Taxpayers Federation and a couple other little groups and all of the people. Like, that was the thing, was that the poll showed that the poll showed we were losing at first, but our campaign was so effective that by the end it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Won 63% of the vote, I think, on and defeated that tax. And, you know, that was a line I think that Jordan stole from a former premier, Bill Vanderzam, I think, years before, that, you know, everyone agrees with you except for the people.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what we've seen. And certainly you talk about committees, it's everyone but the people. Like, I remember early Harper years, like 2006-ish. Our federal director at the time was in there giving testimony, talking about I think he's a member of parliament now. He was in giving testimony about cutting spending, cutting taxes. And one brand new rookie MP at the time stopped him and said, hang on a second, I'm confused. Like, I've just heard from like 300 groups in a row over the past like 3 weeks who have come in here and asked for more money. And I've tallied it up and they want to spend like $3 trillion of money. Yeah, at that time, the budget was about $200 billion. So he's like, they want to spend, you know, multitudes more than what we spend the entire budget on additional things. And you're the first one to hear saying spend less money. Like, it was literally hundreds and hundreds of lobbyists and activists and whatnot in there talking about how much more money the government should spend. And we were there, one group talking about how we should spend less. And we had the people with us. Like, I mean, the poll showed that the Harper government was highly encouraged to cut spending, balance the budget, and continue to run an efficient, fiscally conservative government. But you would never have guessed that from a poll of the lobbyists. If you asked the lobbyists all to vote, the budget would have been $2 trillion. Like, that's really, I mean, I was pleasantly stunned when I read Pierre Poilievre's op-ed back in May in the National Post, fire your lobbyists. Now, I know some lobbyists. Some of them are very, very good people and very, very effective. If you need, like, if you need a small regulation changed, call a lobbyist, because they know probably the right bureaucrat to call and who has their finger on that dial to change a small regulation. And sometimes those regulations are absolutely ridiculous and need to be changed. But if you want big things changed, you can't rely on lobbyists, because they're going to work for their masters. They're going to work for those who are paying the bills. And, you know, we're in the same situation, except for we got a whole lot more masters. Last year we had we had 36,000 Canadians donate to the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. If we were a federal political party, we would be the third largest. We had more donations last year, more donors last year than the federal NDP party. And we do it without any tax credits. You don't get the most generous tax credit in the country when you donate to the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. So I know we have the people behind us, and I've seen the polling, and I've seen the power of having tens of thousands of people pushing the politicians. But Poilievre's not wrong that if they let the foot off the gas, if we let our foot off the gas and our supporters let their foot off the gas and just say, he's got it, he'll take care of these things, we're going to lose repeatedly, because it is hard being in Ottawa, being a politician, when the people you talk to more often than not are other politicians and bureaucrats and staffers and lobbyists. That's who you talk to.
Yep.
You know, again, Ralph Klein, my favorite politician, I keep quoting him. He used to talk about dome disease, you know, talk about the dome over the legislature in Edmonton. He would talk about dome disease. You get in there. And I mean, I could put it in probably a less nice way about drinking your own bathwater, but that's essentially what it is, right? You get all these same people in there, all the same politicians all talking to each other, and they all think that what's going on in parliament or what's going on in the legislature actually matters to real people. And they really care about the to and fro of who got the best of who in question period. Reality is most people don't know what that is or care about it. They care about the bottom line. They care about, can I afford to feed my kids, get them to soccer practice, and can I afford to maybe occasionally get a Disney Plus subscription without ads? You know, I mean, these are the kinds of things that real people talk about. They don't talk about who got the best of who in question period. But when you get the dome disease, or I don't know what you would call it in Ottawa, and it's not quite the same dome, but when you get dome disease, You need real people to remind you of what actually matters to Canadians. And, you know, we've got 36,000 donors and hundreds of thousands of supporters on our list that are hopefully, fingers crossed, ready and willing to take up the fight, even after there's a Poilievre government there, to keep them moving in the right direction. Because, like, we've already mentioned a few things that, you know, we've not got. Poilievre has not talked about how many bureaucrats he's going to fire. He's not talked about what he's going to do with the Senate. He's not talked about industrial carbon tax. He's not talked about the capital gains tax. There's a lot of things that he's yet to commit to that we're going to have to hold his feet to the fire. And I think that he is going to give us the best chance to get some major victories here in the next 2 or 3 years, but only if people make him do it. Politicians like to be pushed, and they only move when they're pushed, and we're going to have to be pushy.
I can see him acting. I think he'll act quickly on something like the capital gains tax increase, because he voted against it. And not only that, remember, they did that little mini documentary. I think it was 12 minutes long. So explaining what capital even was for people. And I learned a few things listening to that. So I see him moving quickly on that. But you're right. We should get him on the record beforehand if this all goes according to what it looks like the polls are going to say. Drinking your own bathwater, you must have been where I got that line, because I said it recently with an interview with Tristan Hopper, and he messaged me the other day to say, every time I'm having a bath now, I think about drinking your own bathwater. And it's like, thanks for that, Tristan. To your point on Dome disease, Franco, do the kids there in Ottawa still call it Ottawashed?
You don't hear it too often, but yeah, you do hear it. And it really is something here, right? Because look, you get to Ottawa and then all of a sudden you're so important. You're just so important. Everyone tells you how important you are, and the work that you're doing is just so important, right? More important than, you know, the people who are actually working to run our economy, produce stuff that everyone gets. So like, Scott's absolutely right. Look, they talked to a bunch of lobbyists. They talked to other politicians, other bureaucrats, other staffers, and lost in all that chatter is the fact that Canadians can't afford to keep paying for this bloated and costly government, right? So look, I think 2025 is honestly going to be a very pivotal year for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. I think all of the years that we've been in an organization for 30 plus years have been very important, of course, but I think 2025 is really, I really do think it's a potential for a really make type of year, right? I think what Mr. Poilievre is a politician who is inclined to want smaller government. Mm-hmm. He's inclined to want to cut taxes, pay down the debt, balance the budget. But as Scott has mentioned time and again, is that politicians first and foremost want to get reelected, right? So if it's Canadians who aren't pushing him in the right direction, he won't go in the direction that we want him to go. So I think we have a very good opportunity in 2025 leading up to that next election, if we just keep fighting to really make the next government go to lower taxes, go to less spending, go towards a balanced budget, go towards more transparency. But really that all depends on the work that everyone on this conversation puts in. And of course, to our audience who's listening to it, because where the strength of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation comes from is not from Scott or you, Chris, or me in doing our jobs. Our power comes from how many Canadians we have who are taking action, right? The power is with the people.
You know, Franco and I follow American politics probably a little bit more than you do, Scott. But Scott, you probably saw this whole DOGE movement, right? Department of Government Efficiency. So mm-hmm. Elon Musk and some of his friends have gotten together, interestingly, and taken an interest in government waste and government spending. Well, that's something we at the Taxpayers Federation have done since we started. We hand out little golden pig statues to politicians and bureaucrats who waste your money in spectacular fashion. And it's interesting. It just kind of came to mind, Franco, when you were describing that, of the tax fighters' job, our mission right now. And a lot of folks on X have been saying, hey, Taxpayers Federation, you're DOGE. But that doesn't mean us three. That means the people listening. That means our donors. That means our tax fighters. So, Scott, do you see the Taxpayers Federation, with all of our army behind us, being able to root out government waste and be that kind of Department of Government Efficiency, but on the Canadian side and in the Canadian style in the next government?
Well, I mean, certainly, I think we've got a leg up on a lot of people to help do that, just based on our history. And the fact that we've also got a full-time investigative journalist working on government waste issues. That's so we have Ryan Thorpe, who's a brilliant journalist who's been on this podcast many times. He is doing a one-man doge in the Ottawa office there with Franco, digging up government waste. I mean, that's what his job is. When we hired an investigative journalist, we weren't looking for someone to go out and, you know, scrum the politicians and ask them questions and chase them around and you know, report on the intrigue. We wanted someone who was going to file ATIP requests, access to information requests, who was going to, you know, go through the order papers, who was going to read through the boring stuff that a lot of people ignore in Ottawa and dig out government waste. And, you know, to Franco and to Ryan's credits, I mean, we've had a dozen front page newspaper stories on government waste stories that we have dug up. And there's been probably 30 or 40 more that didn't make the front page that made, you know, page 3 to 5. Like, there has been dozens and dozens. And if we probably had 2 or 3 Ryans, we could probably do even more. But look, I think that there's no shortage of government waste. Government waste is not an American thing. It's not a Canadian thing. Every government has waste because whenever you have someone spending not their money on not them, they're wasteful with it. I mean, that's just human nature. You're wasteful when there's no incentive for you to not be wasteful. You're wasteful with other people's money. And that's what happens. And we've got countless examples. In fact, when we have our Teddy Awards every year, I mean, there's like a 3-hour phone call in which all of our directors fight each other on who gets to win the award because we've got so many nominees.
Yeah.
And even when we do our nominations, like, try to get it down to like 4, 5, 6. Painful some years, and we're leaving great ones on the table. And I would say increasingly that has been, they've been dug up by us.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we saw this with the media. The media has been failing and collapsing over the past decade. I mean, I remember, I've been doing this for 20 years now. When I used to go to the Alberta legislature, I'd go down to the press gallery and it was bustling. Like, there was like 20 reporters in there all, you know, and you could go down there and take a news release and hand them out and you would talk for 3 hours with reporters. You know, fast forward to like 2009, you could shoot a cannon off down in those offices and not hit anyone. Like, it was, there's been a big change in the media in the last 20 years. And because of that, we've lost a lot of good investigative journalists who used to dig up government waste. I mean, back when we used to do the Teddies 20 years ago, the vast majority of the Teddy Award winners came from journalists who had dug up really interesting stories. Today, the vast majority are coming from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, from Franco and from Ryan Thorpe, who are digging up these stories instead of the media. So we're doing a one-man media job ourselves. Do I think that can be an entire government department? No. Would I like there to be a Canadian doge? Absolutely. And certainly we would be happy to contribute many of the ideas for it. But there are a lot of citizen journalists out there. There's lots of opportunities for regular people to go out and do this kind of digging and look into government departments. It costs, $5 to file an access to information request?
Mm-hmm.
They're practically free. They're practically free to go out. If you have a burning question, you see some sort of government department or doing something and you want to know how much it costs or why they're doing it, you can file an ATIP request in 10 minutes, fire it off for $5, and they legally have to give you an answer. That is the law. They sometimes break the law, but they are legally required to provide you with an answer. So I think that, you know, I'd love to see, 10,000 of our supporters out there filing access to information requests and digging up government spending stuff. I think it would be great. And there'd be no shortage of opportunity for us to cut spending. I mean, this is such a huge bloated government now that, it'd be like shooting fish in a barrel.
It would. To your point on 2 points. One, with the media, you're right. Back when I first started, I was largely a court reporter covering crime. And there used to be at the front bench of every courtroom, like, you'd have designated seating for media with their names there on the chairs because they were always there. When I graduated from journalism school back in the 90s, there were 2 full-time, like, pay your mortgage level salaried reporters working for the Vancouver Sun on softwood lumber.
Wow.
Yeah. That is how much things have changed. And so that is also why I find the Taxpayers Federation fascinating, is that we have evolved along that time. And now we are producing a lot of the content and helping out with both mainstream and alternative media of, oh, here's that clip. Hey, did you see this? It's more of a symbiotic relationship now that I find. Franco, do you have, sorry to surprise you with this question. Do you have a favorite story of government waste that you and Ryan and your cat Ludwig have dug up over the last year or so in the Ottawa office? Because I think the German sex toy thing was the year before, so I don't think you can answer that one. So do you have one from the last year?
From the last year?
Yeah.
There's just so many. But okay, so this has been kind of a multi-year issue. But you know the CBC bonuses? You know all the parliamentary committee stuff that's been going on? All of that happened because of the Taxpayers Federation. Mm-hmm. We were the first one to break the story that this, or it was our A-tips, that showed that the CBC was handing out bonuses. Now you start to see the mainstream media talk about it. It's one of the big news stories of the year is the fact that the CBC continues to pay out millions in dollars in executive bonuses. Well, let me fast forward a couple years back. Now, we've been going after the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation for quite some time, right? They're the ones spending tax dollars funding research into a home equity tax. Well, Jake, who is now a full-time part of her team, when he was an intern, he just wanted to file an A-tip about the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation and this new climate position that they hired for. So he filed the A-tip. The A-tip officer at the CMHC sent us back a whole bunch of records that were showing bonuses. And we're like, wait a second, the CMHC is handing out bonuses? Like, what is going on here? So then we filed separate A-tips to the CMHC for their bonuses and all the different Crown corporations' bonuses, right? So that's how we first found out that these Crown corporations are handing out taxpayer-funded bonuses. And now at the, now the CBC's bonuses are just under fire. Essentially, MPs from all parties are against the CBC bonuses. The poll shows that the vast majority of Canadians are against the bonuses. Even the Friends of Canadian Media, a cheerleader for the CBC, is against the CBC bonuses. So, this isn't just a this year story, but I just love the fact that we're shining a light on these greedy government bureaucrats, especially those at the CBC who are taking bonuses with the taxpayer dime. That's probably my favorite one.
And on that point, and to take them further behind that woodshed, on the issue of bonuses, you'll often hear apologists for the CBC intone something like this. Oh, well, what are we to do about Indigenous programming if we defund the CBC? Newsflash for you. You folks are spending more on your bonuses than you do on Indigenous programming at the state broadcaster. So don't you let anybody tell you that we need the behemoth that is the CBC to defend Indigenous programming. As an aside, APTN, the Aboriginal People Television Network, which is broadcast out of Winnipeg, which is almost entirely self-funded, does a much better job of covering Indigenous issues in Indigenous languages with a fraction of the funding. So yeah, don't let anybody get away with that. I would agree with you. I'd say as far as meat and potatoes go, of the long-standing story that has changed kind of the narrative, even in the hallways of Ottawa, it's the CBC bonus story. So that's a really good one. Scott, any final words before I wrap things up?
No, look, I just want to say thank you to all of the many supporters and donors of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, and thanks for everyone for watching. As Franco mentioned, it's not the big brains on this call that make change in this country. It's all of you. So keep up the good work, and we'll try to hang on and keep pushing for the same stuff that you guys want.
Amen. And in order to join the taxpayer army that we so often refer to, go to our website, taxpayer.com. Find the petitions that speak to you, okay? If you want to defund the CBC, if you want to cancel the firearms seizure, if you want to balance the budget, if you want to scrap the carbon tax, all that stuff is there. Sign up on one of those petitions, and then you are automatically part of the Tax Fighter Army. And we'll send you updates when it's time to have all of us mass email or mass phone call or do something really interesting to push a politician to do the right thing. So head on over to taxpayer.com. That's where we're fighting for taxpayers.